Hey everybody, Jason here. Before we get into the episode, I just want to mention that I just found out that Richard Roundtree has passed. Richard Roundtree, born July 9th, 1942, died October 24th, 2023. American actor. Of course, we know him mainly from the blaxploitation genre. Great, great actor. You know, I've enjoyed just about every role that he did, everything from Shaft on to things like Q, the Flying Serpent. But he did a whole variety of different things, and he was really good in just about everything that he did. Sadly, you know, he had gone back and forth with cancer over the years, over the past couple decades, and he finally succumbed to pancreatic cancer. So it's a sad day, and definitely an actor that I'm going to miss.
Well, pop yourself a beer or a cold libation. Let me tell you how I wrote this little theme. I went and took a call from Brother Jason, and he tells me that he has a little dream. He says he needs a backwards intro to begin his podcast, and I ask him, what you got? He said, I'll start off with some talking and some movie clips, some popcorn fighting, fantasy explorations, and some groundless exploitation. Kickstarts that I'm watching and some blind unboxings, full month horror movie marathon. Sometimes I let the dogs come on, contest and of course you know it's all about games. I said, slow down, let's just start with the name. It's the Nerds RPG Variety Podcast.
Welcome to Nerds RPG Variety Cast. I'm your host, Jason. Today is an interview with an OSR creator. We're going to talk to Aaron Clark about his rule set, Holmes and Clark. I hope you enjoy the interview. Joining me today is Aaron Clark, who is, well, he's been around for a little bit. How are you doing today, Aaron?
Great, Jason. Thanks for inviting me to come and talk.
Thank you for coming on the show. I'm excited to talk about your rule set. But before we do that, let's kind of talk about your, let's say, your gaming history, your RPG origin story, just so our gamers or our listeners. We're recording 10 o'clock p.m. my time, 7 p.m. your time. So I may be a little bit punch drunk. We'll see how it goes. But to let our listeners know kind of your gaming background.
Sure. I was born in the 70s, in 71, and gameplay was always a big part of our household. I can remember being very small and playing games like Candyland or Chutes or Ladders and things like that with my mother and my brother, and some of the older kids in the neighborhood, things like Operation or that puzzle game that used to pop up and things like that. I remember those games a lot. There were games like Life and things like this in my background. But when I was in about third or fourth grade, I heard about some Dungeons and Dragons, and I didn't know what it was, but it was on my Christmas list. I really wanted to have this Dungeons and Dragons game. It sounded awesome. I didn't know how it worked. I didn't know how you played, but it didn't matter. And Christmas morning, I got the Holmes blue box for Christmas. And it was awesome. It was so great. All the illustrations, the big color cover, and I dug right into it. But I quickly realized, being, you know, 8 or 9 years old, that I couldn't parse these rules. I didn't understand how it worked. And fortunately, my uncle was there, my uncle Jim, and my uncle was a kind of a closet war gamer. A summer or two later, I would go to his house, and he had a closet that was racked from floor to ceiling with board games, with SPI, with Avalon Hill, with all these Hex and Counter war games. And I was like, what are these? He said, well, they're games. And I said, can we play them? How do you do this? I need more of this in my life. So that's a little bit about my backstory. My uncle sat with me that Christmas morning, and he tried to puzzle through the rule book. He didn't really understand it, but we rolled up a character. He told me what kind of characters you could play, you know, fighter, wizard, thief. Oh, I want to be a thief. Okay, good. So We roll up our stats. And what I remember about that experience was pulling the counters out of the cup because we didn't have any dice. And my thief had a dexterity of 3. And I didn't know what that meant, but it didn't matter. It was still awesome. So maybe one day I'll resurrect that character, that Christmas morning character, some sort of thief with 3 dexterity. That could be fun.
Oh, very cool.
So how about you? How did you get started? What was your backstory?
Yeah, pretty similar, actually. I'm a couple years behind you. I was born in 73, but I didn't get into this till the early 80s, or, well, like 84 probably, because the Mentzer Redbox is my first set, which probably was pretty lucky because that's actually a really great learning set. It's a really great set for somebody.
And it's beautiful too, right? I mean, it's eye-catching. It has lots of great illustration.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And back in the day, you know, we had that. I ended up buying all the Beckme boxes and having all that. But we pretty quickly moved to AD&D and then played AD&D. I didn't actually see or own BX or Holmes until about 20 years ago.
Okay.
And I now prefer BX to Beckme, but you know, back then I didn't, you know, I don't know that we ever really played correctly back then anyway, to be honest.
Basic, expert, something, immortals. Is that right? Is that Beckme?
Basic, expert, companion, master,
immortal.
Oh,
master and immortal. Okay.
Yeah.
By the time Beckme came out, I was playing AD&D like you were. You know, you kind of graduate out of those systems.
Yeah.
I love Oney. I think it's fantastic. I still play it today when I can, but you have to have the right group of people that are interested in playing a game like that.
You do. I've been lucky enough. There's a group of us, a lot of us are actually here in the area I'm in like Virginia, Maryland, that area. And, you know, unfortunately, because of schedules, it's been sporadic lately, but we've been playing and we try to play. Maybe not exactly rules as written, but just the challenge of trying to play as close as we can. Not that there's a right or wrong way to play, but just, you know, it's kind of fun trying to do it. You know, oh, we're going to do overbearing. Let's actually, try to do it the way the rules are written. And
right. I think that's super interesting. Yeah. Looking back at that kind of historical reference, like what was the intent here and how does it work at the table? Mm-hmm. You know? There's a mechanic in 1E that I really like, the initiative mechanic, which is based in segments, and both groups roll a D6, and then the difference is something about like the delta and where they start on the segment line. I think that's really cool. Mm-hmm. I've tried running that. But I'm not even sure I've interpreted it correctly, right? From the bit of reading I've done around it. You know, guys like Huso run 1E pretty much as written. I think he takes a few exceptions, but that's fantastic. I mean, I would love to be able to play a game like that with players and a GM that are, or even run games like that, right? Mm-hmm. But it's hard, right? That's asking a lot of everybody at the table.
It is. It's a commitment. And I end up playing a lot of other games that, you know, aren't D&D at all. I've got one I've been running lately. We've had a ton of fun with is a 1986 Canadian game called Night of the Ninja, where you're playing ninjas in the 1980s based off. You remember all the ninja movies in the 80s that came out.
Sure.
It's a role playing game of that, playing ninja mercenaries in the 80s. And it's a blast.
It sounds great.
But
I left the role playing hobby and the late 80s, high school, you know, girls and drugs and rock and roll. That was awesome, right? And that just distracted me from all other kind of hobbies or pursuits. And I didn't really, but I always kept with tabletop gaming, board games, war games or Euro games later, miniature painting, that kind of stuff was still a big passion for me. I just didn't do much role playing. And then in like 16 or 17, in the sort of the twilight years of G+, I I rediscovered role playing. I started to hear things about like this DCC. I started to see blog posts from Courtney Campbell, and I was like super fascinated and really interested. And I started to hear this podcast, this Hobbs and Friends podcast, where Jason Hobbs was talking about all this old school gaming. And one of the first episodes I listened to, he had a fellow on and they talked about Swords Without Master, which is a, I guess it's like a story game, right? But it's sword and sandal, it's Conan, it's everything I love about sword and sorcery. And I was fascinated. I dived into the whole indie scene and started crawling around in that space and just really got inspired by role-playing. And I ran at one of my local conventions for a pack of friends at DCC, that Sailors on the Starlight Sea. And we had a table, like I remember being a kid going to the library and all the big kids would run games for the littler kids or all the other kids in the neighborhood. And there would be these tables of like, it felt like a dozen kids, 20 kids, all playing D&D together, right? Just this chaotic affair. And at this game convention, I ran the Sailors game, the DCC game, and we had like 12, 14 people at the table. And it was awesome. It was amazing. It was great. It was fantastic. And that's just what kickstarted my whole renewed interest in role playing. And then this whole OSR kind of scene, sort of looking back at the original source material and how do we reshape that with a modern perspective, whether that's editing, layout, new ideas about how to play, and that's what I've been doing since, right? So now I would say role playing is kind of the top of one of my hobbies, right? And probably my most active hobby. I still do those other things. I still do board games. I still do miniature war games. I still paint miniatures. I still do that kind of stuff. But you know, the scale has tipped a little bit, you know, in the other direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. So I've been able to play Swords Without Master. It's something, I don't know, it's like maybe 2017 when we played that, or 2018, something like that. And it's a really interesting game. It's about, you say story, it's about as far from, it's just barely a game, right? I mean, it's totally a game because there is a randomizer there a little bit.
I don't think it's a game in the way we think about it traditionally.
Right.
Right?
Yeah,
it's I would say it's a very I'd say it's a very modern game. Yeah. I love it. I've run it. I've played it. I try to run it at the conventions regularly, and people will show up like, oh, I've heard about this. I've never played it. You know, and getting a chance to share that experience with them is pretty fun.
Yeah. I think everybody should give it a shot. It's a blast. I really enjoyed it. DCC is another one. Out of all the D20 games, especially the newer ones, DCC is my favorite by far. It just, you know, the chaotic magic and the uncertainty and the, you know, kind of the swinginess of it and the vibe, the art, it just all, you know, it just all works.
Yeah, I think it's very good. It's very good. It's the book is massive, but I think because of the nature of magic and I think the nature of the way we think about publishing, mm-hmm. I'm a real minimalist, right? When it comes to anything that's text related, I had a boss many, many years ago, and he used to say, if it can't fit on in a single sheet of paper, it's not worth reading, right? And he was talking more about, you know, like business requirements or reports or those types of things. But I really have taken that to heart. Because we're so overwhelmed, bombarded, right, by so much information daily, that if I have to sit down and slog through a dozen pages to get to your conclusion in some kind of report, I should have just read the conclusion. You know, I should have done what I did at university: introduction, conclusion, and relevant sections. Right?
Yep. Definitely. Well. So let's talk about the OSR, and let's talk about your rule set, this Holmes and Clark rule set, because
it's about the most OSR rule set that I've come across lately. And I mean that in all the best ways, because you're taking Holmes, which is as old school as it goes, right? Traditional as it goes, as far as role-playing games. And you're adding in, you know, happily things from here and there. And this rule set does such a great job of attributing where you're getting ideas from. I love that. And I love just the way it's set up. And you're kind of also embracing, like, you know, Rob Conley talks a lot about the idea of OSR and the idea of the free sharing of ideas and not putting things behind paywalls and all. And you've done that here. And it really, it's a really neat rule set. I'm really glad that I think I heard or came across it before, but then when Rich Frazier over at Cockatrice Nuggets was talking about it recently, it brought it, you know, to the forefront, and I grabbed a copy and read it. And I said, I need to talk to him.
Okay. Well, yeah, thanks. I think the first thing about this, these rules is that they're free. All the content that I produce in the hobby and in the space, I want to be freely accessible to anyone. I don't think the hobby's too small, and my time too little to really kind of commit to trying to make a business of it, right? And I think whatever money I did earn from any kind of hobby publications would be quickly consumed by tax or fees or whatever else. So I just decided in the beginning, when I kind of set out on this journey, I said, okay, everything's free. That's easy. I don't have to get tangled up in licensing or complications around that. If somebody wants to cease and if Wizards or Hasbro wants to cease and desist me, awesome. I will take that and frame it, you know, and wave it around like a badge of honor. That would be pretty cool. But I think what I've also tried to do with the rules is attribute, right? Attribute everywhere, what's the source of some of these ideas, but also not step on the toes of any IP or trademarks or those kind of things. I just launched the rules on DriveThru, and they have a review process, and they said, oh, you know, your control panel, and we can talk about those later. You have some art here that's, or you use the Dungeons and Dragons term in some of your art. I'm like, where? I don't even remember. And they pointed out, I was like, oh shoot. So I just redacted that from the PDF, right? That's the easiest way around that. And then, you know, if I have time or interest or capacity, I can make those things available on DriveThru, but they're also available on my blog too. So I think those are like the three key ideas of where I'm coming from. Simplicity, right? Everything should be on a single piece of paper, single sheet of paper or less. Attribution. Everybody should be acknowledged for their contribution so that if you're interested in those ideas, you can go and explore deeper. And then at cost, or no cost or at cost, right? Mm-hmm. I do have a print on demand for these books. I've got a copy here at my desk. So if we want to dive into the rule book or look at any sections, we can do that. So those were kind of like my starting points. And then the starting point was like, well, why I did this is maybe more interesting. Why I wrote this rule book was I was playing a lot of, we have this local convention here called Pigface Orc Con, which is an OSR, old school role-playing game convention. And it's run by a fellow named Thomas Wendt. And Thomas, the first year I said, oh yeah, I'm going to run Holmes. That'll be awesome, right? Because for me, it doesn't get any older than that. Little Brown Books, maybe. I messed around with those after Holmes with the cousin. So I went to run Holmes, and I'm like, this is awful. Not awful, but it's a wall of text, right? The rules are very fragmented. They're not very long, so it's not too difficult to kind of parse. but it doesn't become an easy reference at the table, especially for many, many players who maybe, I don't remember how to play Holmes, or I've never played Holmes. I don't know what the delta is. So one of my first kind of publishing initiatives was to create these control panels for the player character and for the both and the DM, so that from a single page, you would have everything that you need to refer to in the rule book, everything that you need to essentially run and play the game. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, you could dig into the rule book if you want to look up a spell or something like that, but all the core rules were kind of distilled down to one page. And I don't know if you've seen those control panels or not, but that was the starting point. And they were firmly baked in the context of Holmes. Those are available on my blog. And we played that game and it was fantastic. And then we started playing, we played that game at Pigface OrcCon, and then the pandemic happened. And we just started playing lots and lots of games online. And I had this this dungeon, this free dungeon from Gabor Lux, mm-hmm. Castle Morthmayan, which is a multi-level dungeon set in a wilderness area with the supporting hex crawl map. And I always carried this around in my back pocket along with my Holmes book, so that I would be at conventions or later we would be stuck at home online and I'd be like, I can run D&D. And then we would just sit down and play, which is kind of the way I remember playing when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. So from that, I started creating this, compiling this list of house rules, like ways that I wanted that kind of expanded or refined on what Holmes was doing or things that I liked about the game or that I wanted to see more of in the game. And it started to get to be like this, I don't know, 12, 24 page document of house rules. And new players were coming to the game and I told them, okay, fine, I'm going to write a rule book so that we have an agreed set upon common framework, right? Mm-hmm. That contract at the table. And it probably took me two years to do it. But it's not easy to write a rule book. I mean, you know, it's easy to bang out a few ideas and put them on paper, but then to do the editing, okay, that's not too bad. But then to do the layout, that's a little more challenging. Then to kind of do all the spit and polish, that's even more challenging. But then the worst part of it is like the desktop publishing, trying to figure out how to get it from a Google document to a PDF to some print on demand house like Lulu or something. That was a real struggle and a real chore. But it was also an interesting experience, right? Because I think so much we talk about it in our hobby about you know, content creators are producing these types of materials, and I wanted to try it, right? So I did.
No, and it's, you know, the final product, or, you know, the current product is very nice. You know, it's easy to read, you know, two column for the most part. I mean, you know, it depends what we're looking at, but basically two column layout. The art is not overwhelming. You know, you've got plenty of art because people expect to see some art in there, but I think the art's about right, you know, about the right amount of, you know, percentage of art to text kind of thing. The tables are easy to read that you have in here. Now, I really like the layout. I think you knocked it out of the park there.
Thanks. Yeah. I wanted that two column layout. I went as close to the traditional fonting that I could had easy access to. That 20th century Gothic, I think is what it is. Anyway, it doesn't matter. If you want the fonts afterwards, I can share them with you maybe for the show. Oh no, it's in the book. I think I talked all about that in the author's notes. And then the layout itself is very black and white, right? I would say grayscale layout. All the tables are kind of that alternating bars type of thing that I remember from the D&D books. All the art is in a gray scale. The art is all old book old book art that then I push through a couple of filters to get a common look and feel. And I think that was pretty successful. Thank you. I'm glad you like the layout. I'm glad you like the look and feel of it.
And we talked about
a labor of
I cut you off. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off there.
I'm glad you like it, right? I'm glad you appreciate it. I'm glad you like the look and feel of it, right? That's nice of you to say. Thank you.
It's true. And you talked about attributing things. Sorry, but English is my first language.
Words
so well. Words are hard, but when we go and we go to your appendix I, you make sure you attribute each piece of each individual picture you've attributed in here.
Which I don't. I'm used to seeing in more kind of like academic works, those types of citations about illustrations and things like that. And even though all of these artists are long dead from the 1800s, 1700s, 1800s, whatnot, I thought it would be interesting to somebody if they said, wow, I really love that image. Who did that? You know, I think that's harder to find in the OSR community, in the OSR material, I think it's definitely hard to find in the original source material. You know, you might see tags like DAT and things like that and know, wow, I really like that artist, but as a kid, not know who they are or not know where to find more of their works from. Right.
I mean, for me, when I read a book, I love reading, I love nonfiction. I love fiction too, but I love when books have footnotes. And you know, if I pick up a book and the bottom third of the page is footnotes, I love that. Cause then I'll go and I'll follow the trail, you know, the breadcrumb trail to the original works and read that.
Right.
I love that. So.
Right. And that's like an added layer of the knowledge that you get to expand on that subject or that topic. And you get to follow these weird paths, right? These weird tendrils, you know, pulling on these different threads and having a whole new discoveries.
But you still kept it. What I like with this is you kind of kept, obviously it's not one page of rules, but you kind of kept that one page philosophy. So if you have a player who isn't playing, a new player comes to your game, they're not going to play a caster. They're not going to play a magic user or cleric. There's 23 pages in your rule. You know, you can hand them the book. You can say, you know, read the first 23 pages. That's all you need to know. If they're playing a magic user or a cleric, then they have 5 more pages for the rules of magic and then whatever spells they have. It really is pretty condensed. I mean, it's half the size of Holmes, right? Because I think Holmes is 46 pages. I might be slightly off, but it's about half the size of Holmes.
My Holmes book here's too as well. Maybe I'll find it. That's an interesting observation, one that I hadn't really made. When I was pulling this together, I really, really wanted to do like a saddle stitch binding like the Holmes book, but the page count by adding the magic just got too big. So I just went for the traditional soft cover binding, that glued binding. But yeah, that's a really interesting observation that the core rules are maybe 22 pages, right? And half of that is for the DM. I would not even say it's really for the player characters, though I think the DM is a player in their own right too. You know, that's kind of the philosophy that I bring to the game table to an RPG.
Yeah. Nothing in there is secret knowledge, right? There aren't in that first 23 pages, we don't have descriptions of magic items or we don't have anything that should be behind the screen really. So there's no harm in players reading any of that.
Right. It probably just gives them more insight or maybe hopefully encourages them to go and run their own games, right? To whether it's this type of game or another type of game, or maybe, you know, or going and creating something else. I will say that in writing these rules, I didn't want to just do another retro clone. I just didn't want to do the same old, that's probably the wrong way to say it, but I didn't want to just rehash old ground, right? I wanted to bring some new ideas to the table. And I think I succeeded in some areas in doing that. One of the big ones that comes to mind is stats and stat challenges. You know, I wanted to find a way to make your 3D6 down the line meaningful, because in more traditional sets, I would even say in Holmes, a 9 is an equivalent to a 12. An 11 is equivalent to a 14, right? There's no variation there. And I had played a lot of games where it was, oh, you want to do some kind of stat challenge? You want to test your wisdom? Okay, D20 or under, or 3D6 or under, or 2D6 or under if it's really easy, or 5D6 or under if it's really hard, you know, those kind of things. But it was still a very binary result. It was still like a pass-fail result. And it didn't feel like there was any way to grade that result. So kind of leaning into what I was reading about and playing in the indie scene, this kind of yes and no but kind of idea, I tried to club on to the 3D6, right? The stats down the line, the traditional D&D stat block. And I think that works as long as you don't rely on it constantly. Mm-hmm. I've gotten tangled up in that, relying on it a little too heavily. It's most successful, I find, in my games when you use it when you're uncertain as a dungeon master, kind of what would be the result of what a player is trying to attempt, or, wow, gee, I don't know, I hadn't thought about that. Well, you know, test your intelligence, right? Oh, no, and, man, you are effed. Demons show up. Yes, and it's amazing. No, but you learn this other little thing, right? So I think that can be, like, very kind of like really lean hard on the improvisational side of role-playing, which I think is super exciting because I love being surprised at the table. I love being surprised by what my players do. I love surprising my DM when I'm a player. I love being a DM and being surprised. Like, that's so exciting, right? The game just went in a totally different direction that I didn't imagine it was going to go. That's fantastic.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, when I design, you know, scenarios, I come up with a problem, but I don't worry about how it's going to be solved because the players aren't going to follow any thing I'm going to come up with anyway. But which is great because then I can react to what they're doing. And if you know your world and you have a feeling for the NPCs in your world, then you're going to be able to improvise with the players as this goes. And that way, both, like you say, the DM's a player too. And that way everybody's getting to play. And it's much richer than if you're going, you know, in the super linear thing where they have to pull the stone out to solve the mystery to get the key, and that's the only way to win, you know, free the princes or whatever. You know, it's so much better if we can work together on that. So no, I'm with you. One other thing you borrow from the indie scene, well, not necessarily from the indie scene. Although you did, you borrowed it from you cite Knave, but something we don't normally see in OSR game, right? In the increasing levels, you have the opportunity to increase stats, which a lot of people, when you think about it, you have 3D6, and I know the way I roll dice, you know, I'm lucky to have anything over 12 if I'm rolling 3D6. I end up with single digit, I'll have 5 single digit attributes, you know, with my starting character.
Right. I totally agree with you on that. But that's just one way that you can level your character. I wanted to provide a mechanism by which a player could shape or change their character, grow them into this vision that they had without having to write a lot of rules about, oh, you get these traits or you get those skills and you do this stuff and follow those trees. I didn't want that, right? I wanted wanted flexibility and I wanted creativity and I wanted it to be very open-ended. And Nave really inspired me with that idea. We were playing Nave with the Rasping Sands. Right. I don't know if you've seen that procedurally generated setting. Fantastic setting. I love it. It's amazing. I want to try to run my Holmes and Clark with it, with Rasping Sand. I think that would be awesome. But the idea of Knave's, I think when you gain a level in Knave, you choose three different stats and you increase them. So yes, that's an option in Holmes and Clark when you gain a level, or you could just take a traditional hit die. Or you could, let's see, what do we say? The other reason I wrote these rules is so that I could remember the rulings that I had come up with instead of having to try to contradict myself sometime in the future or like, dang it, I forgot that really good idea that I had 3 weeks ago when I was running this game. Mm-hmm. Plus one to hit, plus one to your save modifier, gain a weapon skill that you didn't normally have, like magic user with swords, or what about a magic user with armor? That would be awesome. Or other creative advancements that you can just come up with. Like I had one player that's like, oh, I want to be able to move freely in plate mail. I don't want my movement rate to be knocked down. Okay, take that as one of your leveled advancements. Now you're a mailed panther. How does that sound? Oh, that sounds awesome. I love this idea. So players are constantly kind of, and it creates a tension too in the character creation. I love this tension of choice and game design and gameplay where, man, I got two great things. I don't know which one to take. Mm-hmm. this tension of choice. And it creates a real tension of choice and leveling. Like, oh, my stats are like at 14. If I just took a 15, I'd be a plus one in these areas. Oh, or do I take the hit die? I only got 3 hit points. I need more hit points. I don't know what to do. I love that.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned hit points. One thing that you do in here is you make use of the constitution score matter. So it's used both for wounds, I guess. I'll let you describe that. And then we can also bounce to spells because you can use it to retain a spell that you've cast. So I'll let you talk about it. Because both those are really interesting.
Yeah. So one of the tough things about D&D, low-level D&D especially, is 0 hit points and you're dead, right? DCC has this mechanic, roll the body. At 0 hit points, I think you test your con or something on D20 to see if you're still alive and just like barely alive. That's pretty cool because it gives your friends who watch you fall an opportunity. Like, do we leave him? No, he's kind of a jerk. Let's just leave him. Or no, we really need to rescue him. We can't just run from this fight. Or we got to drag him with us. We got to figure out how to get him out of here. So hit points in Holmes and Clark are not a measure of your health. They're more like a measure of your vitality. And once your hit points go to 0, you test your constitution on a flat D20 to remain conscious. And any damage you take after 0 hit points, those become the true wounds. Those become the broken bones, the cut bellies, the blinded eye, the whatever it is. And I really storyboard with my players, like, what does that wound look like? Oh, it's like this. And then that gives an opportunity for lingering effects, right? This takes the player out of action for days, if not weeks, right? As they're kind of recovering or struggling with this injury. And maybe that'll always be with them. and then at 0 constitution, then you're dead. You test death. You can make a death save to see if you're like barely clinging on. But I think that lets players maintain a stake in the game with their characters. Sure, if I go to zero hit points, maybe death is always on the line, and maybe I can say, oh, and he's just dead, right? That's okay. Or maybe you want to play this game on hard mode where zero hit points is dead. Go ahead and do that, right? That's fine. And then for magic, one of the tough things also about low-level D&D is you maybe have one spell as a first-level magic user, maybe a couple of more if the rules allow for an intelligence modifier to boost the number of spells you can memorize, or wisdom modifier if you're a cleric. And I do that here in Holmes. I think that's a nice boon, mm-hmm. To a casting character. But for magic users specifically, because I envision them as real practitioners of the dark arts, really kind of pushing the envelope wherever they are, is that once you cast a spell, instead of letting it slip from your memory, you can take constitution damage. And as you progress through the adventure and you continue to kind of retain and hold these spells, as you progress actually through the day, because sometimes an adventure will last more than one day, game day. It's one con penalty. Oh, it's two con penalty. Oh, it's four con penalty. Oh, it's eight con penalty. Oh, it's 16 con penalty, you know. And then there's this real struggle and choice as a caster. Am I going to burn all that con and then go to zero hit points because I only have a D4 hit die, and then test my con and be KO'd? You know, all of this tension, right? But maybe you want something a little more flavorful, a little more colorful. So I've created some simple charts as kind of inspiration that a player can roll on, or they can tell, or the player can say, this is the price that I'm willing to pay to hold on to this spell. And we think about it and we say, okay, well, how many times have you held on? Has it been drastic? Is it painful? Is it fearsome? Is it devastating? Right. And then kind of come up with that context. And then what I want to do is like just continue adding to this chart, right? So as I hear more players talking about more cool ideas about how they held on to that spell, how they clung to it, what price they paid for it, and it can go on the chart for others to kind of enjoy later.
Right.
You know, so the chart might be like at the lowest level, break every non-magic weapon on your person. Or at the devastating level, at the other end of the spectrum, sold your soul and fail any death save, right? That's pretty awesome.
No, I love that mechanic. And, you know, one of the cool things about Holmes, when we look at Holmes compared to the other TSR era D&D rule sets, is Holmes kind of looked at, and I don't know if this is something he got from Warlock or if he came up himself, but the ability for low-level magic users to make scrolls. Because in just about all the rule sets, you have to be high level to make a scroll.
Oh, yeah.
But in of course, Holmes wouldn't let you adventure with your spellbook either. Holmes said your spellbook has to stay in your wizard tower, right?
And maybe that's why he allowed scrolls, right? I don't know.
But I love scrolls. I think it's great.
Yeah. I think it's great too. And his Dr. Eric Holmes approach to scrolls, 100 GP a level, right? That's simple. That's clean. That's elegant. That's so tight, right? And then it gives me, as a magic user, it gives me ways to spend and consume the treasure that I'm earning. I like scrolls too. A lot of players, my experience with magic using players is they don't often take scrolls, maybe because they have the ability to retain that memorization. Maybe it's because they get additional memorization off their intelligence mod. Okay. Maybe they don't think it's necessary. I don't know. But at later levels of play, what I've seen players do is that's when they start to sort of lean into the scroll mechanic. Right?
Well, they're great
running a magic.
I cut you off. I apologize. I was going to say they're great for utility spells. You know,
absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, there.
I think playing a magic user is the hardest class to play in any kind of D&D, followed by clerics. I think clerics are also quite challenging to play, only because you're kind of as a player, I want to think about, well, what's the spiritual nature of my character and what's the relationship to my D&D, my deity or God? And then how does my magic then apply? Because now I have to kind of, I'm quite different than in most D&D sets that I play. I'm quite different than a magic user where I only have a few set spells that I can memorize from. I have this collection of spells that I can memorize. And I think, I believe in, or my rules follow a principle of spell memorization for both clerics and for magic users. I think that's a portion of that interesting tension of choice. But the other thing that I've done with clerics is given them a one-page reference to in a pantheon of gods and deities within the core book that they can choose from. And this follows quite closely the Courtney Campbell concept published in his Pandect 3, where he talks about this idea of how do we make clerics not so one-note? How do we give them, how do we provide them with abilities that are informed by their deity, informed by their gods, and give attention of choice to the player about, oh, I'm going to try and test to get that next new thing. I'm going to get that next new power. Oh, now I can do this. Oh, I'm only two away from the big giant power that I want to have. But Courtney's Campbell's ideas also provide this kind of these observances and taboos. So these are things that you must do as a cleric, and these are things that you must not do as a cleric. And if you do them, then you lose one of your special abilities start degrading, right? So I think that idea is fantastic. I've sat with many of my players creating deities for their cleric-based characters that are really inspired. And then again, all of that's on one page. It's a simple reference. You don't need books and books and books to tell you reams and reams of paper about how this relationship between the cleric and the deity operates. It's all about the fiction of how that operates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an appendix, I think, Appendix P, Pantheon. It's great because you give examples and then there's a blank sheet that people can just mm-hmm. photocopy and make their own. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah.
The other thing you talk about giving options, you know, earlier in this talk, we talked real briefly about initiative and AD&D. So for initiative, you know, I think you've recognized, like a lot of us have, that, you know, every group has their own different kind of flavor of initiative they like. So what you've done is given a variety of options. Hey, these are some different initiative options. Check them out. And, you know, all of them are pretty neat. And I mean, even to the point of, you know, almost doing the one from, I'm tired. What's the game that's basically advanced fighting fantasy? Troika. You effectively have the.
Well, yeah, with the cards and the tokens and stuff. Yeah, I was listening to Ray Otis talk about initiative in one of his podcasts, and he was talking about all these systems, and I was like, yeah, they're all these different systems. And OD&D Little Brown Books uses it. I think they D6 group initiative, but I'm not entirely sure. I'd have to look back. But Holmes definitely uses dex order, mm-hmm. right? Monsters have dex, players have dex, and use dex order. Side-based initiatives, pretty common in the OSR. And, you know, then the four M's, and do you do that by sequence or do you do that by phase? Or random order where you go clockwise or counterclockwise off the player who rolls the highest die. Or then blind, like Troika does with chits or cards. And so what I what I tried to do in the rules is summarize all of those down to a single page. All seven options there are on a single page with a simple procedure that could inspire player groups or GMs or DMs to kind of come up with, oh, I like that, or oh, I want to do something else. But I think what's most important about initiative is just, you know, that contract that you make at the table that this is how it's going to work, right? Maybe another session or another game we'll try a different way. But I think that's one way that rules in the past have tried to differentiate, like, oh, I'm going to do something totally different with combat. Oh, my initiative order is so, you know, upside down and creative. Right? I think those are interesting ideas, but I don't think that makes or breaks the game, mm-hmm. right? The combat initiative.
Right.
But you could spend pages and pages and pages trying to describe all of that.
No, I think you just, you know, putting all these on the one page, I think is great. Talking about combat, one of the things in a lot of these games, depending on the version, the poor fighter often gets left out. And you've borrowed a mechanic inspired by Dungeon Crawl Classics.
Yeah.
The Mighty Deed for your deed die, which is an amazing mechanic that makes fighters feel awesome.
I think it makes them feel like fighters. And I think that's what's important for every class of character is they have that little special thing that makes them kind of unique, kind of interesting, and kind of different. Fighters because they're amazing warriors, wizards because they have that spell and they can do lots of magic, clerics with this relationship with their deities, and then the demi-humans, elves, halflings, and dwarves. We can talk about those if we want to, but I could probably talk about this all night, so I want to be respectful of your time because I know that you're getting tired too.
Oh, no, we're fine. I just, we could definitely go through the whole rule set, but of the notes I wrote down, the only thing I have left here that I think does deserve a mention is the Arnesonian dice, because it's such a great idea. And I've seen and heard of this before, but it's nice to see it in a rule set with an example, just laid out.
Yeah, I was playing games with Jason Hobbs and he would do this Arnesonian dice thing. And I would constantly press him on this concept. Like, well, how does this work? I mean, where does it come from? What's the source material? I want to go back and read it and reflect on it and kind of try to tease it apart about what Dave Arneson, arguably the father of tabletop role playing, mm-hmm. Or at least the grandfather, I'm not sure. so what I heard from Hobbs was, oh, it's just talked about in the hobby. Oh, we just, you know, I'm just trying to kind of make it work at the table with some ideas. So I sat down when I was writing these rules and said, oh, I want to include this mechanic. How do I do that? How do I make it a procedure? How do I give guidelines and framework? And how do I measure the result of those dice? So the way my interpretation of the fabled Arnesonian dice work is there's something that you're trying to achieve within the game. And it could be as simple as bribing the guards captain, or it could be as grand sweeping as taking over the empire, right? Anywhere in between that stuff. So you say, okay, well, what's the result you're going for? Okay. Understood. Both sides start with 2d6 and you start counting advantages. Oh, I'm trying to bribe the guard captain. I've been drinking with him all night. I'm giving him 500 gold. I'm a pretty girl. Okay. That's three advantages. So you're going to roll 5d6. What's the card captain go against him? Well, he doesn't really trust you. And he knows that if he goes against his master, he's going to get eviscerated. So that he's got 46. So then both sides roll the dice and you take the highest result. But if you roll any doubles, you must take them. So by rolling more dice, you're kind of increasing that tension of potentially rolling that double. Like, oh, I rolled an 11, but I got a double. I got a pair of twos. Oh, I got to take those twos. What does this mean? And then provide some guidance about how to stack those results. So obviously, the highest result will achieve their goal, bribing the guard's captain or resisting the temptation in our simple example. But a double indicates an exceptional result, even if it's even if you're on the losing end, right? So let's say let's say you bribed the guard captain successfully. You rolled a seven, and he rolled a pair of twos, right? So he rolled double fours. Well, that's kind of a low order result. He goes along with you, but he doesn't trust you, and you don't trust him, right? There's this tension between that relationship, and then that builds on the fiction that we can create within the story, right? Mm-hmm. I think, and then you can continue to resolve along those lines using the Arnesonian dice until the situation or the scene becomes clear, and then play just progresses naturally. Right? I think it has worked well at the table. We've had some good outcomes, and the example that's provided in the book, in the Arnesonian dice section, is an actual play example. Right? Mm-hmm. So that was super fun.
Very cool. Well, I don't want to go talk about everything in the rule book, because I want people to go check it out. And since it's free, yeah, there's no reason they shouldn't.
I hope everybody goes and checks it out. Right. I've been, you know, I there's no marketing behind this other than kind of word of mouth. I'm really fortunate that Rich Frazier is playing in my online game. We're basically neighbors. He lives, you know, 20 miles south of me. And we meet up at the conventions, and we met online and realized that we are in the same part of the country. And have been kind of meeting up and playing games at the different cons, and that's been a blast. So there's no marketing behind this. I kind of promote it where I can, like on Reddit. Now it's on Drive-Thru. I share it with my Facebook. I share it kind of, you know, if I tell two friends, maybe they'll tell two and two and two and two. I can't remember that beauty commercial from the 70s, but it could work or it couldn't. And that's fine, because I don't really have any skin in the game, right? I have this reference now to play the game, to have that common contract with my friends or my players, or when I go to a convention, you know, here's your control panel. Go ahead and write, roll up a character if you want, or here's some pre-gens and let's start playing, right? Oh, you know, yeah. I want everything to be simple and accessible and approachable within the OSR. And the other, I think what I'll wrap up and say is that the rules strongly encourage drawing on other sources, right? Whether that's magic or magic items or deities or classes or whatever, but it also strongly encourages simplification, right? We don't need chapters to describe how magic works. I don't think that's beneficial, right? It might be inspiring, but I don't think it's beneficial for gameplay, because then you get lost in the rules trying to find that reference or how this spell works, or I'm an elementalist versus necromancer, or, you know, that kind of stuff, I think can be, again, not beneficial to play at the table. Yeah.
Right. We didn't even mention, but you know, the back of the book has the first three levels of spells.
It does.
And yeah. Very simplified, easy to understand, and set up where you could just take those and, you know, hand them out and people could have them.
I'm working on a deck of spell cards, which will be a print and play kind of PDF thing. Maybe it'll be on Drive-Thru with their card thing. I don't know if I can figure that out, but you know, I like that idea of being able to have these quick, simple references without being stuck in the book about, oh, I'm a level 5 magic user. I've got about 8 to 10 spells. It's a lot to digest, right? Yeah. Yeah. So, man, this was fun.
Thanks
for letting me yammer on and talk about D&D, which I love, right? I'm very enthusiastic about the hobby now. I love playing, I love running. And I love kind of sharing new ideas. You know, how do we focus on the play, not the rules? How do we focus on the fiction, not the mechanics, right? I think that makes for a really dynamic, fantastic, fun, and interesting game.
Well, yeah, I agree 100%. Folks, there's going to be a link to Aaron's blog in the show notes. There'll be a link to the Drive-Thru RPG. If you go to the blog, I'm going to link to the page that has a link to these rules, to the control panels. There's a link on that page to go to Lulu for a print. Now, there's a note on here to not order hard covers. Are people okay ordering soft covers?
Soft covers are okay to order. In fact, Lulu's pulled the hardcover because there's a printing error there was some sort of offset with the cover where it left a little white strip. And if you ordered a hardcover, you probably got it that way. You might have contacted Lulu and complained about it. Maybe they refunded your money. I don't know. I haven't heard any negative complaints other than from friends who sort of give me a hard time saying it's the collector's hardcover edition. The white strip, they're calling it. So if you've got the white strip and you're dissatisfied with that, let me know and I'll make it right for you. Again, I think the hardcover retailed for its cost from Lulu was $10. The soft cover is $4, probably cost you about $10 with shipping. If you wanted that, but again, this is all purely at cost or no cost. Because I don't have a for-profit model here.
Yeah. Right. So all that's going to be in the show notes. And I, again, want to really thank you for taking the time out to come on the show and to talk to me about your game.
Oh, and I'll wrap up and say, I've got a Discord focused on the rules. If you're interested in this game, if you want to play a game, reach out. I'm happy to run as our schedules can align. I do run some open table games. If you're interested in that, hop on the Discord or message me on the blog and we can find some ways. Or heck, even if you wanted to play by post, we could do that too. So fun times. D&D is fun times.
It is. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Great.
I hope everybody enjoyed listening to that as much as I enjoyed talking to Aaron. It was a great conversation. All those links are in the show notes. Please go check out this rule set, Aaron's blog, and get out there and game with some people. We talk a lot about the rules. We talk a lot about theory, but we need to get to the table too. So make sure you're getting some gaming in. Until next time, be excellent to each other.
Joke about your spouse, but the operator's screaming it's coming from inside the house. What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? Well, the audience is pretty sure he took a pretty head, and the only question left is if I could shoot him dead. Bring on the gore, bring on the gore. I want some more, bring on the gore. Butcher is a dustman and your moil is by the tipper, and I'm assuming that your partner back there in the wood chipper. Don't look away, don't look away, don't look away, don't look away. Well, the zombies are arising and the world has gone to heck. We're living for the dying and we're dying for the trick.